Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I'm joined by my co-host, our bearded guru of teeth, cocks, and wheels, watchmaker Michael Woods of Woods Watchmaking. Hey, Michael, how's it going?
Oh, goodness. Hi, how are you?
Very well. I'm just trying out the intro for size. What did you think?
Nice intro.
I thought that captured your essence very, very, very well.
Did it now. Thank you very much.
We've got a great show ahead. Really, really excited about our guest today.
Yeah, just super excited.
Absolute pleasure to welcome Mr. Kieran Shaker to the podcast. Hi, Kieran. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Kieran.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. Hey.
Look, Kieran, when we were drawing up our list of dream guests, I mean, your name featured certainly in multiple lists, so we're very, very excited that you're with us. Probably maybe the best place to start, Kieran, maybe you can give us a bit of a quick bio so our listeners who don't know you will learn a bit more about you, and we'll kick it off from there.
Oh, sure. Where to start? Watch-wise, I guess my main thing is I have a company that makes silicon watch parts. And so we silicon hairsprings and things like that. So that's kind of my main thing in the watch industry. But I've done a lot of other things. I've written some stuff. I wrote a couple books. Wrote a book about F.P. Journe, which was the first book on the company. Just recently, I wrote a book on De Bethune, which is not out yet, but hopefully will be out soon. It's in editing right now, so I'm as eagerly anticipating it as anyone else is. And other than that, I've worked at Contrabant, which is a pre-owned watch dealer for primarily independent watches, and that's really my main thing. So like the books and the articles I've written and the dealing I've done and my own collecting and my own interests, it's generally in the independent space. So I know that lines up well with this podcast.
Certainly does.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons I wanted you, Kieran, to do your own intro, because you're a man of many talents. I had a whole list and I thought I didn't know which way to introduce you. You've got too many strings to your bow, which is very, very good.
Yeah, I haven't introed myself in a while. So I was like, oh boy, where do I start? I'm probably forgetting something. I have a podcast. That's, I guess, the other thing, a watch podcast. Yeah,
that's all good. We've got you covered. We've got a list. We'll work through it. I should have just said Renaissance man. You know, that would have really got you together. No, that's brilliant.
Roman and I are big fans of your podcast. So that's how we sort of got introduced to you. At least I did anyway. So, I've been following. Whenever an episode comes up, I certainly can't wait to listen to it.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And Michael and I are usually the first ones to discuss it. Have you listened to it yet? What do you reckon? Well, pretty good. You know? So we probably feature in your first 10 listens as the podcast kicks off. Well, look, what we might do, what we tend to do here is we'll do a round of sort of drink checks and wrist checks, which is one of our segments, and then we'll kind of launch into our sort of discussion points. Michael, we might start with you. Do you want to tell us what you're drinking and what you're wearing?
Yes, well, actually, I've got a beer with me today, and I only noticed today, it's quite fitting, but it's labeled as a Melbourne brewed independent beer.
Nice.
Yeah, because I got it out of the fridge and I thought, oh, that's perfect. But it's a Hawker's XPA, Melbourne Brewed Independent Beer. And it's quite nice.
What does the X stand for? PA is pale ale, right? But what's X?
Yeah, good question. I know what I stands for an IPA, but I don't know what X. I'll have to look it up. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure. All I know is I like the taste of this one. and then also I had to wear a watch that was somewhat independent. So the only watch that I've got that's close to an independent is one I built probably 10 years ago when I was working in the industry for Rolex. And I was just having some fun and just put together a watch and basically modified the movement and hand finished it. So it's a no brander, standard dial and Breguet numerals with sort of Breguet hands. And then it's got a 6497 or 6498 in it. And I just refinished the movement basically. So I haven't worn this in years. So I thought I've got to wear something a little bit more independent considering we've got Kieran on the podcast. So yeah, that's what I've got.
Nice.
Beautiful. What about you, Kieran?
So I'm wearing a Vincent Calabrese watch, the Trans World. So it's probably about, this watch came out probably about 25, 26, 27, something around that, in that ballpark, years ago. So it's, you know, by independent watch standards, it's pretty old. And yeah, I'm a fan because, you know, I think, well, multiple reasons, but, you know, his stuff, beautiful. It's very legible for the size, and it's a great way for me to show people that you can get an independent watch without spending 20 grand. Cause this watch is like three or four, you know, kind of, so yeah, they're out there. So, you know, it's, it, there's no matter what your price point is, there's an independent out there for you no matter what, but you know, a lot of different price points. Yeah. Yeah.
At every price point. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I think you just, oh, and give us your drink first and then we can launch into a Trans World discussion.
Sure, sure. It's pretty late at night here, so I'm drinking water, but I'll say earlier today I was drinking IPA. Sculpin's Ballast Point, which is a beer that I've always loved, and I remember at one point going on Beer Advocate, you know, the beer nerd website, and I think it was their highest rated IPA. I was like, yep, not surprising. It is fantastic.
That's very good. Very That's cool. good. I just looked up that Vincent Calabrese watch you just mentioned. And I don't think I've seen that piece before, actually. It's quite interesting looking. Mm-hmm. How did he finish the dial? Do you know? It's like a mottled. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to answer it if you're not sure, but it's.
That's what everyone asks. Let's see. Yeah, I'm trying to remember if I found a description of that once.
Ah.
Yeah, I used to own one of this because I think you and I might have even interacted about that watch a while ago, Kieran. Maybe
you had the 52, right?
I had both. The 52 I've got on my wrist now, so I'm really excited that you had Vincent Calabrese's name came up. But yeah, so I've had the Transworld. The Transworld I find really interesting because that's the one with the second time zone, which is completely independently set. You can set it within a minute of the home time, which is unique. You know, there's no other sort
right.
of, and the other thing I really like about the Transworld, and we'll put up a picture, and I'll certainly dig out a picture of the ones I used to have or the one I used to have. It's the same kind of, it always reminds me of the Konstantin Chaikin Joker watch in that ability to sort of presenting time in hours and minutes as the two sub-dials. That always reminds me of whenever I looked at my Transworld, it always reminded me of the much newer Konstantin Chaikin, which obviously doesn't have a second time zone, but just uses the two eyes as the hours and minutes. So I really like the Transworld. It's a brilliant watch.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
You know, there are those watches out there that are the world timers. And I think, I forgot who it was, probably like Blancpain or someone like that, made a world time watch that actually covers the weird time zones. So like the half time zones, like India and I think Venezuela and a few others.
Yeah.
And that's great. That's one great way to do it. But this is also a totally much easier way to achieve that same thing.
And with the dial from memory, because I remember asking Vincent directly by email about sort of refinishing a dial, which I had a Power Reserve one, sort of in a similar family, but much simpler. So they are a silver textured dial. So I think from memory, what he said is they use a handheld burr to kind of rough up the edges of a silver dial to give it that kind of almost flaky moon cratery kind of texture. So it's a hand finished silver dial, silver textured dial. They're beautiful. The watch I've got on with me, once again, is a Vincent Calabrese, completely coincidental. We don't sort of rehearse these things beforehand. I've got Model 52, which is their annual calendar watch from Vincent Calabrese, which sort of has the day indicator, date, and then a week, number of weeks, you know, 1 to 52 across the dial, and the power reserve at the bottom.
Very cool.
Which, once again, it's just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful dial, beautiful watch. It's an ETA-based movement, but I think Vincent created his own module, I think is 1.2 millimeters thick or something that fits on top of a standard movement, which is brilliant. And one of the reasons I actually dug that watch out of the safe today, looking through your Instagram, Kieran, that was the very first watch you posted on Instagram. That was your post number one.
Was it? Wow.
I even looked up the date. It was the 8th of July, 2015. So we're in 11th of July, 2020.
Wow. Yeah. So you scrolled all the way back to the start.
Holy smoke. Five years almost to the day.
Well, I will let people peek behind the curtain. This doesn't just happen, We do a little bit of work beforehand. It's mostly, there's not a lot of research on this podcast, but that was the least I could do.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been a huge fan of Vincent Calabresi's work, and I know Kieran has as well. So I'm really glad we're talking about Vincent now, because he's a lovely, lovely guy, like a fascinating story as well of, just if we're going to talk about any independence, I think Vincent, drop out of school, started working as a watchmaker at age 14 or something ridiculous like that, and really came through.
I think he ran away from home.
Oh, so right. There you go.
Yeah. I think he ran away from home and, needed to support himself and supported himself working at a small, watch repair place. And that was, at this point, over 60 years ago.
Mm. Yeah, wow. That's, yeah. And he's still going, bless his hands. So it's incredible.
Yeah.
I was just sort of reflecting, Kieran, on where I would have heard sort of your name first or how I came across you as a person. And it must have been during the, the Watch Forum era, talking about sort of the independence, which is kind of where I was learning about independence. And that's where your name really came through. And like you, I have sort of a fondness for this sort of generation of independent watchmakers who might have sort of preceded the internet age a little bit, like Vincent Calabresi or Sven Anderson is another one I know you've spoken about. The Secular Calendar Watch, for example, which to me as well is one of the best calendar watches ever made. And there's a whole bunch of them that sort of don't really, Thomas Prescher is another one, where you can know about him, but he's not really widely spoken about. So yeah,
right,
very, very cool. Alrighty, well, look, let's have a bit of a chat about you, Kieran. You're our special guest. As you were saying in your bio, you've got a lot of strings to your bow. So you're an engineer by training, and you run a company which manufactures silicon hairsprings. I mean, how did you get into that as a particular niche for part manufacturing, and how's it going during the COVID era?
Well, I guess ultimately, I like to make things, and that's, one of my favorite things to do. And my academic background is, in physics, the sort of where engineering meets physics. And so I was actually doing semiconductor research back in grad school. And at the time, it just wasn't that appealing to me because it was doing research as opposed to R&D, which I find much more interesting and much more my thing. And also, that immediate feedback aspect of it where, I remember once asking my PhD advisor, I was like, so when do you think this stuff that we're working on, when do you think it'll see a commercial application? And he, came back, shot back right away, like, oh, not in our lifetimes.
Oh, goodness me.
Not in our lifetimes. That's a long time, yes,
Right.
It was very fundamental research.
Sure.
Wasn't as appealing to me. And so I left. But then at some point I realized, that work in semiconductors, that can all be applied towards the actual making of things and watch things. It's a way of combining my academic past with my, my love of watches. So it was, it was a great fit. And, I really wanted to do something novel that was going to, make a mark, in the industry. So,
that's really, really interesting. I mean, that kind of resonates with something a previous guest once said to us. So we had Ian Sean on the podcast. Yeah.
It was
a great episode. So,
yeah.
And then he sort of mentioned something that when he was doing his studies, once again, he went in thinking this will be hands-on, I'll get to make stuff. And it was very much theoretical, wasn't quite practical enough for him. So I think then he lobbied his university or college to set up a machine shop for the students to actually get some hands-on experience. So it's really interesting how the world of academia doesn't quite deliver on the practicalities as opposed to basic science research or even advanced science academic research. That's really interesting. Now, with silicon manufacturing, I mean, there's a couple of things in my head that automatically goes. I mean, A, it's a very niche thing. I mean, hair springs, there's hardly any companies that make hair springs. There's probably two or three in the industry. Silicon hair springs would be an even smaller subset of that. How did you settle in on hair springs? And also, what is it like to manufacture those on the wrong side of the Swiss Alps, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'll answer the second part of your question first, which is, I think anytime you're making something outside of Switzerland, the bar is so much higher. You know, you are automatically going to be perceived as probably not doing it right, or probably not doing a good job, or probably not doing it at all. And in fact, just outsourcing it to some, you know, factory elsewhere that's actually doing the work. An important thing was with all the customers was taking them inside the clean room to see everything themselves. So, you know, I have a picture of Francois Paul Jorn, you know, who was the first customer, playing, you know, suited up in the clean room, wearing the full suit, playing with the, you know, with a wafer full of silicon hair springs, and me, you know, suited up, standing right next to him, like sweating bullets, like, you know, like, oh God, I hope he likes it, you know. You know, that I think is what a big thing about doing stuff outside of Switzerland is, you don't get a second chance. You better be great, and you better be great the first time, because you're already dealing with so much skepticism. You already have so many points against you that you really need to bring it.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
And then that actually leads into the first part of your question, which was why hair springs? Two reasons. One is it's probably the hardest part to make. And the second is, starting with the hardest part, well, though, it's probably the hardest part to make. And therefore, by making that, you've kind of proven your cred. Because it's like, if you made an easy part, people would just say, well, you made that one easy part, but can you make a medium part?
Right.
You know, okay, you made a medium part, but can you make a hard part? You know what I mean? So by making the hardest part, you know, you got the credibility faster, I'd say. The second part is the hairspring is the part where silicon, there are probably two parts that naturally everyone thinks of when it comes to silicon, and those are escape wheels and hairsprings, because that's where there's the biggest benefit within the movement. So that's the second reason for that part is, you know, it's, yeah.
Sure, it sort of makes sense. And have your parts been sort of tested in brands or watches that are being made right now, or are you still kind of in the, we can make them, but we're now looking for commercial partners to commercialize that, if you know what
I mean? So far no one has put it in a watch for sale. But you know, but it's already been sold, you know, to Jorn, like I said. But we have had testing done by both Jorn and another company that's sort of where a friend of mine is the head watchmaker. He offered to, he's like, well, we can't do it. You know, we can't be a customer. It's just doesn't fit, you know, blah, blah, blah. For various reasons. A big one is cost. You know, we were not, the goal of this was not to make a, like, hairsprings are actually already pretty inexpensive, traditional ones, or even very inexpensive. This part is definitely not inexpensive. It's actually quite expensive. So the goal was never to make an inexpensive part. And so it just didn't mesh with this company. You know, it was well over, it was like, you know, over an order of magnitude more expensive than a traditional hairspring. So it was just out for them. But he's like, you know what, though? We have a very robust test facility, so happy to put it through, you know, as a favor. And yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, hairsprings are really interesting. I mean, I'm thinking the last innovation that I could think of in hairsprings most recently was the Tag Heuer hairspring that they made with carbon something, and that was being released with great hoo-ha, and then it kind of faded away as far as I'm aware. So hopefully yours is a smoother sailing into the industry. Yeah. Wow.
Well, you know, the big thing right now is good old Corona.
Of course.
You know, so the lab is closed because of Corona. And it's unknown when it'll reopen. So, the prospects are not good. Yeah. So, basically it's unknown, just to finish the thought, sorry. it's just unknown what, to multiple things. One is, who knows when the lab will open? First of all, it's at Columbia University. So first of all, presumably the university has to open. And there's a lot of political pressure on universities and things to not open too early.
Of course.
So it's not about when you have permission to open. It's about when are they going to choose to open. For example, I think it was Harvard that just announced this week that they are not necessarily planning to open for the next academic year.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I didn't read the article too closely. I kind of read the headline. But if they don't open for the academic year, then I think it's going to be very difficult for any other university, certainly one in New York City, like Columbia is, to open.
Sure.
And so, there's that pressure. And then the second pressure is that the lab uses the same PPE as all the COVID people,
Of course. Yes, of course.
Yeah, I'm not saying 100% identical stuff, but, there's overlap.
Yes, and the priority will be healthcare workers rather than silicon technicians, of course.
So there must be, in addition to the pressure, the political pressure to keep the university closed, there's got to be extra pressure on the lab. By opening, you are actually slowing down vaccine research, that kind of thing. So who knows? I mean, let's just leave it there.
But what's really fascinating, what's really interesting is this. I really like this intersection of, watchmaking industry, which is very traditional historically, and this sort of academic research into novel parts and new technologies. We'll talk about your podcast in a minute, which everyone should listen to, Minutia Repeater. But you had Roger Smith on one of the earlier episodes, and he was talking about some of the work he's doing with the University of Manchester, I think from memory, on nano coatings for friction reduction on his movements as well. So it's this really nice, intersection of academia, metallurgical and, materials research and practical application to watchmaking. It's wonderful.
Yeah, this is one thing I always thought was interesting is that there are people who, kind of push back against silicon in watches. Obviously, this is not, in general, no one needs a mechanical watch, right? So,
So
since it's a luxury, fine, you can have your preferences and do whatever you want. It's not a big deal. But their reasons for the pushback, I thought a lot of times just do not make sense. Like, for example, the same equipment that is used to make a DLC coating on the outside of a case is the same, a lot of the same stuff that we use in the lab for making silicon watch parts. And, I've heard a lot of people say, well, I don't like it because, a silicon part can't be fixed. Well, practically speaking, there's no watchmaker in the world, I would be as bold to say, that actually generally fixes parts. If a part breaks, they generally make a new one. There's not a lot of this wheel broke, let me graft on the broken tooth. You just kind of make a new wheel. And Michael, correct me if you think that's incorrect, but
no, that's correct. Definitely. I mean you can do restoration for steel pivots of a wheel or something like that, but if something like an escape wheel or a hairspring breaks, you can make a hairspring, but generally for most watches, you're going to sort of, if you can get the balance complete, the balance with the hairspring together, you're going to get that anyway. You're going to replace the part. So yeah, you're correct.
Right. Or you think about the super low volume guys, who are buying raw hairspring material and and forming their own terminal curve. Most likely, if that metal hairspring breaks or distorts or has some issue, they're just going to get a new hairspring and rewind a terminal. Cool. They're not going to like, okay, let me try to straighten it out.
Or weld it together. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a lot of incorrect information about how your watch is treated when it goes in for a service when there's a breakage. So again, I'm not telling you what to like. You know, like whatever you like, fine. But at least be informed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on that note, I mean, people do argue that point, but my thought is, as we progress with technology in the future, it could actually be easier for access of parts.
Totally agree with you. Totally agree. Parts. I've said the same thing. Like, yeah. Which do you think is... Yep. How many watchmakers have you heard talk about, like, for example, a guilloche machine, and say, oh my God, you cannot find these anymore. And they're so hard to, you know, or XYZ machine, they're so hard to find. Yep. The good ones like they made in the old days.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, in the end, a lot of these old machines, you're cutting metal, you're doing certain, using certain techniques, which they're not easy to do. But when it comes to making a silicon part, with technology advancing, it could actually be simpler. I mean, if you have the design set out, at least.
You know, silicon is one of those things that's not going away. Mm. You know, it makes your cell phone. You know,
yeah, exactly.
The same processes that make silicon watch parts are not the exact same ones, but you know, the same equipment and things like that are used to make parts for your cell phones. Like, do you guys think computers are going away? Like, that's, you know, so the idea that, yeah, at some point we won't be able to make silicon seems really unlikely.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I thought the episode of your podcast that you made recently about ways of manufacturing and working with silicon and just what it takes to make a wafer and, you know, etching and all of that was really interesting. I thought that really kind of contextualized a silicon part and what goes into the making of a silicon part for me. I thought that was really, really interesting. So I can only commend you on that.
I found it super interesting because I had not really sat down to read in full about how silicon watch parts are made. And to be honest, my eyes could start glazing over once I get a couple of minutes into reading it. So to actually listen to it while I was walking was really good. It was cool to listen to. So yeah, thank you.
Wow, thanks. I'm very glad to hear that. Yeah. You know, so when I started the podcast, I generally don't like a lot of watch content that's out there. You know, I've definitely heard people say, you know, very constructive criticism, not you know, not trolls online or anything, but like friends and other constructive criticism saying, you know, this is very unusual or XYZ is different. I've never seen this before and blah, blah. And I'm not saying it's good. All the differences are good, but all I'm saying is I am fine with being different because if I don't like a lot of current content that's out there, then trying to do the exact same thing is probably not going to be better, you know? So yeah. I wanted to produce content for myself because if I'm not a fan of a lot of content that's out there, there are others that aren't also.
Exactly. And I think the level of your podcast is actually a little bit higher than a lot of content out there because you have to be a real watch enthusiast or a watchmaker to really grasp what's being said, which I think is really cool. I think it's great for, I mean, Roman's such an enthusiast that we, you know, he keeps up with us watchmakers when we're talking on the podcast. So, yeah, I think for people like that, it's just perfect. And I, like, for instance, I was geeking out completely on the Equation of Time podcast episode as well. That was so cool.
Oh, that I thought that was one of the few ones, like, that I told my wife. I was like, you know what? I know you don't like watches. I know you have no interest. But this one actually, you know, brings together basic astronomy stuff and things like that. So I was like, you know what? You might like this one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was very good. Very good.
It was. And we actually had, you know, that's the beauty of these kind of independent watches and interesting people is, you know, we had Ryan Schmidt, who was your guest on your podcast, on our show in between the two shows that you made with him.
Right. That's awesome.
So, yeah, it was really good. So then Ryan and I were having a bit of a giggle in between because I said, you know, don't worry, we're not going to bring out, you know, sinusoidal curves. That's Kieran's purview. You know, we're not going to talk about kidney cams and all that. But it was very good. I agree with you. I agree with Michael. It was a fantastic episode, and once again, got us thinking about and really disseminated that knowledge to collectors about just engaging with that sort of content. Advanced content, but delivered in a nice, friendly, non-snobby manner that really brings people in rather than turns people off. So I think you've pitched it beautifully. So congratulations on that.
Yeah.
Thank you. That really makes me feel good to hear that. And, you know, I think you're definitely never, I don't think it's, you're going to ever really bring in big numbers of listeners when you aim a podcast like this or any content like this. But I think the people who do engage may be even more enthusiastic about it. So it's a deeper level of engagement maybe, but yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You, instead of being broader, you're definitely getting deeper level, I think. So, yeah.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think where it ends is a little bit like the independent watchmakers that you and I and Michael appreciate. They never do mass appeal, but the audience they have is very loyal and very engaged with what they're trying to do. So I think, yeah, you've pitched it really, really well.
Yeah. Thank you.
The other thing I was going to ask you about, there seems to be this real renaissance interest in watches and watchmaking coming out of the US at the moment. You know, there's a whole bunch of new makers, you know, like Joshua Shapiro, David Walter, Keaton Myrick. I'm sure I'm forgetting a couple more going through.
Dan Spitz
as well. Yeah, who's a fantastic episode recently. Yeah. And then you've got sort of certainly an uptick in media attention to watches, from Hodinkee to A Block to Watch to a whole bunch of others, to podcasts, your podcast and other podcasts as well. What do you think is sort of driving that? What's behind that in your opinion?
Huh. It's funny that you're asking this, because my point of view is the opposite, in that, you know, per capita, I feel like we lag a lot of other countries in terms of stuff like this. And, you know, we are a huge country, you know, so population wise. So my feeling has been that, like, on a per capita basis, we are kind of behind, but we kind of make up for it in numbers. But maybe I'm looking at it wrong.
No, it's interesting. I mean, the only reason I'm sort of posing that question is because I would like to see a similar wave hit Australia at some point. I feel like we're turning a corner away from the big brands to more collectors engaging with smaller manufacturers like Dan Spitz, Josh Shapiro, Keaton Myrick, David Walter, RGM as well to some degree, you know, where people sort of say, well, you sort of almost get this Daytona fatigue, or Nautilus fatigue, you know, where people go, yeah, no, we get it. Yes, another edition. Look, we get it. But there's an interesting guy in my backyard or in the next state across doing really funky, interesting things. But I think it kind of matches, you know, the interest that your podcast generating. There's a few other podcasts I can think of coming out of the US from an enthusiast perspective or the maker's perspective. There's the Off Hours podcast, you know, with a couple of guys, I think, in Canada as well. You know, really kind of talking about the nitty-gritty of the joys and tribulations of independent watchmaking. Yeah.
That is interesting. Points of view from here and there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The appreciation for watches is growing year by year or decade by decade. And I think people are moving towards mechanical in general. Whereas, you know, 10, 20 years ago, it definitely wasn't like that. Well, it might have been starting 20 years ago again. I think then that appreciation moves to the next level of slowing everything down because wanting something that's more individual and independent and setting yourself apart from the masses, I suppose. So looking at smaller makers, I think, is becoming more interesting. And I think that's how it's sort of driving people to want to be those makers as well. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. I mean, yeah.
I listened to your guys' podcast with Max Booser the other day, and that's something he talked about, which is the backlash and how that would help independence, you know, the backlash of people wanting to be different. And so that, Michael, what you just said, that might tie into that.
Well, I think it's starting to already become a thing. Yeah, definitely, where there's people that are owning some of the bigger well-known brand watches, and they're almost, I don't want to say ashamed, but they're not as proud to wear some of the more sought-after watches now, and they'd prefer to have something that's a little more individual and to stand out instead of being the next person that has the sought-after, you know, hard-to-get model, you know, the one that's shown over Instagram everywhere. So I think we're seeing that change, and over the next 5-10 years, there's going to be a lot more people appreciating the smaller independent companies. So
I hope you're right.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's innovation is so important, you know, for our industry, for the watch industry and for the world in general. Mm. And that's one of my favorite things about independence is per capita, their innovation is so much larger than the big brands. You know, people don't get into independent watchmaking to be like, all right, I'm going to do a Me Too type of watch.
Yep.
It's all about, it's all about making a mark. And I think when you support an independent, you are supporting innovation.
Yeah. And I think in some cases, the bigger brands actually follow the independents. The independents pave the way and do advance the way watchmaking goes, I suppose. They advance the technology and the different way of thinking, and then the bigger brands sort of tend to follow that. So yeah.
Well, tell me what you guys think about this. I think that Zorn is one of the companies or people responsible for the current chronometry focus in the watch industry, because, you know, you think about 18 years ago, he came out with his first catalog, and 22 years ago, he came out with his first watch. And with that very first watch, he put it right on the dial, right, that it's got a Remontois on it. Mm-hmm. And you know, who was doing that kind of talking about watchmaking precision over 20 years ago? And this second watch is a Resonance, again, all about precision. And his third watch, he talked about how he has this loose mainspring, so he, you know, it's more linear. And so he comes out with his first catalog in 2002, 18 years ago, and it's almost like a, you know, going through each watch is a going through a description of different ways of achieving precision. And now everyone talks about that. You know, where you're seeing people doing cylindrical hairsprings and fusée and chains and all sorts of things like that. I mean, you know, it existed before, yeah, but now the focus on coming out with the chronometry pieces and talking about that is much more prominent. And I'm wondering if Zorn is kind of responsible for bringing that to the mainstream, or with someone else.
Yeah, I think he could be right. I mean, yeah, he certainly sort of bridges the diff, because generally independent watchmakers are looked at as people that create art, which is beautiful. And that's a lot of the focus is on the art of watchmaking. But he definitely has for years focused on the art and the precision, and really done something that is almost, people don't generally buy independent watches for the precision, but he's at least focused on that as well. So to have the Resonance is for me a huge piece. I mean, that really sort of shows that he focuses on the tradition of timekeeping and advancing timekeeping as well as the art of it. And I think he's an interesting one, because he's like the one of the only independents I can think of that sort of has gone a slightly above a small independent brand, and he's got the boutique set up around the world. There's no other independents doing what he does, I suppose, in so many ways.
And, you know, you think about, like, in 2004, the Men's Watch of the Year, there was a tie, but one of them was the Zenith Chronomaster T Open, which is, you know, one of their El Primero chronographs, but it had a little cutout in the dial where you could see the escape wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, wasn't there. I don't know why that watch was picked, but I suspect it's because, wow, look at this. You can see the escape wheel, and that's really neat. But, you know, 6 years earlier, Jorn had done that with the Remontoir in, you know, in his Tourbillon. So,
yep.
A bit before his time, maybe. Yeah. It's interesting. And while we're talking about Jorn's, I just wanted to sort of tell our listeners as well, if they're not aware, about your book that you wrote, Kieran, that you wrote on F. Peugeot in the first 30 years, which is a fantastic book. I'm lucky to have a copy because they can be a little bit tricky to obtain, but it's a fantastic book. I certainly heartily recommend if anyone interested in not just F. Peugeot, but sort of independent watchmaking, definitely track down a copy. It's a fantastic thing. It's interesting that you sort of almost put a pin into the timeline of resurrection of resonance and interest in that, because I can think maybe 20, 30 years before, I can almost pinpoint the resurrection of the Tourbillon as something that George Daniels did when he was, you know, making his first watch back in 1969, I want to say, or something like that, where he looked at, you know, he wanted to become an independent watchmaker. He looked at what was on the market and then realized, well, the last handmade Tourbillon watch was made by Albert Peloton before the Second World War, you know, 1941 or whatever, and no one has made one since then. So he saw an opportunity to once again look at improving chronometry by putting a turbine into a pocket watch at that time, but resurrecting that sort of art of independent watchmaking by putting something interesting and also dedicated to precision, which was a Tourbillon, into a watch in 1969, you know, that he then went on to have a stellar career as an independent watchmaker as well. But Daniels, in a sense, had to find a spot point of difference, and he resurrected a Tourbillon, which then I would imagine kickstarted Francois Paul Jorn's interest in Tourbillons when he was making his own in the 90s. So I just think there's wheels within wheels, you know, to use a watch-related simile. It's really fascinating how you can pinpoint independence giving direction to the entire watch industry.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to make it clear, I don't think that Jorn was the first watchmaker to focus on precision. I'm just wondering if he's the one that maybe started a lot of more mainstream brands thinking, oh, we should do that too.
Oh, without a doubt.
Because Daniels is sort of one thing, you know, obviously his work with the coaxial is another, you know, amazing example. But I think people always think of, oh, well, Daniels, he's sort of this guy who does one-off thingies. Whereas maybe Jorn, it was like, oh, yeah, brands, apparently a brand can do it too.
Yeah, he really bridges the gap between independent and bigger brand, doesn't he? Like, in that sense, like he is, yeah, in some ways. And I think what he's doing, and obviously connected with the, he's starting to look at silicon as well, because in some ways you think of Jorn as just really just traditional and would never go to silicon, but I think it's cool that he's actually looking at this point in his career, looking to advance further in technology and the use of silicon.
Yeah, you know, during this whole conversation, you know, I know Jorn's work a bit, you know, having written the book, I did a lot of research, and the way it's normally described is, oh, he's a traditional guy.
Yep.
Or he wouldn't deign to think about that stuff. But the reality talking with him, he's like, you know, he's very much on the record saying he doesn't like silicon. And talking with him about it, he's like, well, here's why. Because I tested it multiple times and he showed me the test parts he has. He's like, look, I had this and I didn't like it. I had this, I didn't like it. And I keep testing it. And when he came to my lab and played with the hairspring, he's like, okay, this actually satisfies me.
Ah, yeah, that is cool.
I didn't mean that to be about me. I meant that to be about him, in that he's constantly testing things. And when he says he doesn't like something, it's usually because he has tried it, looked at it, played with it, you know, things like that, and found it insufficient for whatever. Not a knee-jerk reaction. At least that's my takeaway from, you know, from my conversations with him.
That's a really cool point, because he's not one of those people that sits back and he's set in his ways. And if he does comment on something, it's because he has maybe tried it already And he had that. That's really, really interesting. Yeah.
You know, and I was talking earlier about how I said, look, you don't have to like Silicon or you don't have to like XYZ. That's totally your prerogative, but at least be knowledgeable. And, you know, people think, oh, well, I prefer traditional watchmaking like XYZ does. Mm. I'm like, well, Roger Smith uses, nano coatings now. And Dufour was one of the earliest people to be using CAD and CNC and, you know, things like that. And, you know, who are you referring to that is this exactly. traditional person? I'm not saying there aren't, but
there are, there's a very few people that just like steer away from the use of technology altogether, but that's very, there's not many at all. And they can't produce as many as they want to produce too, because of that.
Right. You know, for me, that was a big part of my wanting to become knowledgeable about watches was visiting factories, because before you visited, it's really hard to know, like, what are you going to do if you want to learn about Thomas Prescher? Well, you read the very, very few things that are out there written about him, and you just got to believe it, I guess. But I've been to his house. I've been to his workshop. You know, I've seen where he does, what he does, and what machines he has and things like that. And so now, you know, it has definitely improved my opinion and reduced my opinion of various watchmakers. Thinking like, wow, I thought you made stuff, but there's very few machines here. What's going on? You know?
Yeah.
The dirty secret of watchmaking, hey? but you're right. Ultimately, you want your modern watchmakers to be empiricists, in a sense. You want them to experiment and try things out and say, well, I'm only going to adopt whatever technology it is. I'm only doing it because it's better than the alternative. Because if we look at the history of watchmaking, I mean, that's what Breguet was doing, the original Abraham Louis Breguet was doing in the 1790s, you know, looking at saying, well, I want to improve the precision of my watches. How can I improve it? Well, I need to counteract gravity. Well, you know, experimenting, and then you end up creating a tourbillon, you know, or a natural escapement that you could never perfect. It was always that striving for more and, you know, striving to improve things by testing things out, not saying, well, you know, I'm not going to touch this newfangled technology. I'm just going to stick with brass and that's it, due to obstinacy. So that's, you want thinking and experimentation. You definitely want that.
Yeah. There's this, I think, view among some people, more collectors than watchmakers, I would say, is that time should be frozen at the time of Abraham Louis Breguet, and we should just keep doing that. Prettier and prettier versions of that. But you know who would not have been content to stay still is Abraham Louis Breguet.
Yes.
That guy was all about innovating, exactly. You know.
Correct. But because Abraham Louis Breguet spent his own career trying to be one step ahead of people who are imitating him. You know, hence the creation of the secret signature and all that, because even his own lifetime, there were people doing what he was doing, maybe not as well, but at least claiming to be as good. So he was always 1.5 steps ahead. So you could absolutely bet your bottom dollar or that A.L. Breguet himself would always be on the hop looking for the next best thing to make his own watches distinctive or better or longer service periods or whatever it might be. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So if I can ask Kieran, so you're clearly, you know, independence is sort of where your own heart flutters better. What's your collecting, your personal collecting is like? You know, are you an active collector? Are you an aggregator of pieces? Are you more of a 5 maximum and then you're always improving them? Like, how do you approach this sort of madness?
Good question. I don't think I have defined my philosophy yet. And it's something I'm actively thinking about. Like, I kind of feel like it's being in therapy and you're like, okay, I need to really think about this and, you know, think about what is driving me, what has driven me in the past, what should drive me in the future, etc. I do know one thing is I like supporting people who are doing things that I like, and especially people who are doing things in a place where they probably don't get a lot of support for it.
Yeah.
Sort of the patronage way of looking at it, because You know, if you think, you know, you guys in Australia or me here in the US or whoever in whatever country, if you're not in, you know, basically Switzerland, it's a tough road. And so helping, patronizing those people and helping them have a market, that's really, that's that I really enjoy. I also like discovering things, you know, because I think, you know how people say like, oh, well, anything you could want to know is easy to find in the, in this modern internet age. I definitely do not agree with that when it comes to watches.
Absolutely.
You know, you talked about this, Roman, with like, you know, you want to find some info about Thomas Prescher. There's a couple posts from a long time ago and that's about it. You know, that's very, I totally agree with that. And it's even more hardcore with other people. Like Thomas Prescher is knowable, but you know, how do you Google the person you'd never even heard of?
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what is an exciting thing that I'm kind of focusing on now is finding those. Because, you know, I don't know, it's exciting.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And that's one of the joys and passions that keeps me engaged and interested is the discovery of new people or interesting people doing, whether it's watches, clocks, measuring instruments, supplying components, doing things in their way, but really contributing to the art and the craft and things like that. So let me ask you then, Kieran, how do you discover people? Are you sort of an avid Instagram scroller? Is it word of mouth? Like, how do you personally discover new things?
Oh, good question. Not Instagram. Not that it's not a source of information, but I just don't do it that much at the moment. What am I doing? I guess following these like gossamer threads where you hear, you know, he is, no one else has done XYZ other than this one obscure blah, blah, blah from what I'm like, okay, wait, let's follow up on that. Who is that obscure whatever you were just talking about, you know, and follow that thread. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, who? Oh my gosh, I didn't even know about this person, yet he was an AHCI member for a while. And, you know, he's the first person to do XYZ. And so I think following gossamer threads is the only way I can describe it.
No, that's it. There's whispers in the fog. That's right. Yeah. Yes. Because I'm sort of similar, because thinking about it as I was asking a question, I have a fairly similar way to you at how I approach things. Instagram, I find, is both beneficial and not beneficial. And if you know what you're looking for, you know, particularly with hashtags and things, it's very good because it aggregates things in one place. But the knowledge and the information is very superficial. I find, you know, it's hard to find detailed information in the post that has a picture and a hashtag. At least I find. What I've discovered since kind of doing the Fifth Risk podcast and sort of being lucky to sort of talk to interesting people really across the globe, I'm starting to get, it's sort of easier than you sort of almost put feelers out and then, you know, see where you get the different nibbles on your different feelers in a sense, because I'm finding there's really cool things that I'm discovering. But once again, it does require a lot of effort. You have to be open and interested to chase up a lot of things.
Yeah.
But it is exciting. If you find somebody obscure or somebody doing cool things, it's very exciting.
Yeah. I think for me, it's probably fairly easy to some extent because I'm always in contact or talking with friends who are watchmakers. And I've got, I know teachers as well. So they're usually got their finger on the pulse and they talk to some of the people that are just starting up with their projects. And so, I'm always talking with independent watchmakers or watchmaking teachers that I know, which is great. You find someone that's just starting. It's really cool to see what they're actually doing. You know, I think that's the way I do it.
You know, that brings up an interesting question. Someone asked me the other day, there are quite a few young watchmakers who have just released their first watch. You know, so I'm thinking sort of like Remy Cools and Cyril Brevet-Nodeau and people like that. And so this person was asking me, how do you decide which one? If you can only get one, how do you decide which one to get? And, you know, I'm curious to hear what your guys would say about that.
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. That's a tough one. That's something that, because there's so many watches out there, and obviously not just independent, but there's so many watches in general, and how to decide. Usually it's sometimes comes down to if it pulls at my sort of heartstrings somehow, or if there's something about it that I'm, yeah, there's like almost an instant attraction. But then once you start learning more about a piece, you have a higher appreciation. And of course, if you get to meet the maker, that's an even another level of appreciation, I suppose. But I would find it very difficult to choose my first independent watch. I would find it very difficult because I don't have an independent maker yet for a watch. But to choose my first, I'd find it very difficult.
Well, no, I was more thinking like when it comes to a young watch, like a young watchmaker who's only got one model out there.
Right.
And, you know, there's not this long track record. You know, you don't even know if you're going to get the watch, really.
Right.
You're taking a gamble. And this can be an expensive gamble. So how do you decide which one of these young, and by young, I don't mean young in terms of age, because, you know, I just mean new. Which one of these new people you're going to bet on?
Tough question. This is a good one for Roman, actually.
It's a good question. I had a watch made by Joshua Shapiro in California. You know, we started this recently, so just really got delivered 2 months ago. And when Josh and I started talking, this was sort of late 2017, early 2018, way before he had any of the media attention that he's got now, rightfully so. You know, before the Hodinkee articles were written, you know, before the collective piece, he was very much an unknown guy. So yeah, so what you're asking was very much my thought process with him. And it came down to a couple of things. It came down to a price point where I was it was expensive, but it was manageable, particularly over a long term. It was price point, how reasonable the person was. You know, could I talk to them? Could I, you know, did I get on with them? And with Josh Shapiro, you know, we got on really, really well. We had a similar outlook on life and, you know, lots of things in common. And that propelled me to then go, look, it's the most expensive watch I have to date, even now, but I'm happy to support this guy because I really like what he's trying to achieve. What you say, Kieran, is very, very true. I see quite a high number of young watchmakers who come out with, you know, their first watch that they just put CAD drawings on, and the price levels, you know, they you know, it's $40,000 or $50,000 or $70,000. To be honest, I don't rate those. I don't engage with those. I say it's really interesting. Come to see me when you make the second one, because I want to see you finish a project. Mm-hmm. You know, like a. So I think an early example that would be, you know, somebody like Pascal Caillon, you know, the French watchmaker who made a series of 60 watches, and, you know, he significantly underpriced his first series. You know, I think there were 5,500, but they're amazing, like fantastic value and all that. I missed out on it at the original release. I had to buy mine secondhand. But I could see him going, well, he took him 3 or 4 years to deliver a series of really well-made, you know, fantastically priced watches. And knowing that he's done the first series, I mean, his second series is now $30,000. It's a completely different price level. But I would bet he will have an easier time selling his second series because he's got the, look, I've made 60. Yeah, I've made my series one. I made it to time. I've delivered them. You know, I'm a maker you can trust. Therefore, I can charge you $30,000. So I'm always a little bit skeptical about new watchmakers who charge huge sums of money without a track record. And I know they're passion projects for them, and the watches are often magnificent, but that's not enough for me. You know, I certainly don't have the resources to really underwrite somebody's dream, putting $40,000 into something which may not eventuate. But having said that, I'm always very happy to support them and try to help them find a patron if I can, to say, hey, somebody who's in a higher income price bracket might be really interested in this. I can, you know, if I can help to foster that, I will certainly do that for you, but that's a price level what I'm, you know, I'm not comfortable in playing. So that's kind of my philosophy in a sense.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Have you, Kieran, have you ever sort of, have you had a watch made or ordered a watch, you know, off the plan, as we say here, you know, so just off the drawings from a completely unknown watchmaker?
Yeah, I have. You know, I, like I said, I really believe in supporting people, and not that this was like, you know, some act of charity or whatever. It was super excited with it. Keaton Myrick, you know, I think what
he's fantastic.
I was confident to make that bet, you know, and the, what his watches are fantastic. That's, you know,
Absolutely.
I'm trying to come up with a more clever way of saying it, but that's just what it comes down to.
Yeah, no, his watches are absolutely stunning. I know a collector in Australia who's actually got one on order now. So he's a collector from Sydney. So he's waiting for a Keaton Myrick piece to be made. So no, I agree with you. Keaton's watches are fantastic. The other thing probably I should have mentioned is geography would play a role in my decision. So, you know, if it was a watchmaker in Australia where I could visit, I would be much, you know, a lot more prepared to sort of underwrite them in a sense, because I would feel like I could meet them, I could pop in, I could touch base with them to see how their project was going. The problem we often have in Australia is we're on the other side of the world. So if a watchmaker in Switzerland or in Belgium or in the US even, you know, makes a project, it's a much bigger leap of faith in a sense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, Keaton's watches are quite beautiful. The design and the finishing on the movements, they're spectacular.
Yeah, you wonder who's going to be the American Dufour, you know, if we can, you know, call someone that. And feels like right now Keaton's the front runner. He's early in his career and he's already doing, you know, this. So I think it's a great sign.
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking to my my WASTEP teacher about him years ago, and my WASTEP teacher was giving him a lot of credit, because my teacher from WASTEP ended up teaching in the US for quite a few years.
Oh.
And so he knew Keaton, and you might know Paul Madden.
I don't know if I've met him. I've definitely heard the name. Let me see if I've met him. Yeah,
but he was the head teacher at Secaucus School for quite a few years. And
okay, no, I haven't met him.
No,
yeah,
no.
But okay.
But he was giving a lot of praise to Keaton's watches as well. And I remember years ago looking into what Keaton was doing and thinking, yeah, that finishing on the movement is spectacular.
Yeah, and the winding feel that, you know, that ratchet that he uses, fantastic winding feel.
It's an interesting, a really nice system, that upper crown wheel that he uses. And you can tell all the teeth are beveled as well, so it's gonna on that winding system, so it's gonna feel beautiful. Yeah,
and it really does.
Yep,
one of the best. One of the best.
Yeah, that's cool.
So is your piece made already, or is it in production now, Kieran?
Made already.
Oh, fantastic, congratulations.
Wonderful. Yeah, he's someone I was very happy to get one of his pieces. Yeah.
No, oh, brilliant. Yeah. No, I remember having a chat with Tim Jackson from Independent in Time, California.
Yep, yep.
You probably know Tim as well.
Yeah, friend of mine. Yep.
Such a small world. It's fantastic. Oh, so well, say hello if he's a friend of yours. Yeah, hello. I met him in London. So he's a lovely chap. So we were having a good chat about Keaton and Keaton's work in Oregon as well. But to loop back on our previous discussion, there's this real groundswell of really cool things happening in the States. I mean, we talked about Josh Shapiro doing, you know, incredible guilloche dials, but now he's sort of started. He's in the process of designing and making a US-made tourbillon movement and an in-house movement as well. I know David Walter, also in California, is making a platinum movement watch as well. It's just really exciting, cool things happening.
Yeah.
So, real sort of resurgence.
Yeah, it's good time.
Yeah, well, it seems to be a sort of a good time in history, and particularly now with kind of the Swiss watch industry going through its own sort of craziness with Baselworld atrophying and all that, there's probably a little bit of a window in time where maybe the indies, and certainly the local indies in the US, will get a little bit more prominence, fingers crossed at least.
I hope you're right. You know, it, like I said, I'm glad we're talking about this because I think you are changing my point of view a bit, because I did not feel like we were really, I felt like we were underperforming other parts of the world. And now I think, okay, maybe on a per capita base, we're actually, you know, holding our own.
Yep.
I think there is a little bit of a kind of tilt back towards American watchmaking. I mean, because America had this tremendous history of watchmaking, you know, through Waltham and Elgin and the Pennsylvania sort of, you know, watch belt, you like. And now I feel like there's a little bit of, you know, the kind of the, to use another, you know, to use another horological thing, the pendulum is swinging back, hopefully, you know, into the right direction. The other thing I was just going to ask you about is the Contrapunt initiative that you're involved in.
Yes.
The side of things. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that and sort of direct our listeners to sort of find out a bit
more? So it started in 2016, and it started actually with a conversation in Geneva, where I was sort of lamenting how a lot of times people tell me that, oh, I'd love to get an independent, it's just I'm worried about resale. And I've heard that so many times. And so I, you know, my background before I was in watches was in markets. And from that, I was, you know, my first thought was, if we had a more robust secondary market, that would really help the primary market, because now people don't have that worry anymore. And so I believe Contrapunt was the first pre-owned dealer that did only independents. Now others have come up since then, but it was the first one to just do that, I think. And so, yeah, it was like one of those, okay, well, and someone said to me, well, if you come in and provide the independent knowledge and do that side of it, then I can provide the infrastructure part. So this was the Analog Shift guy. So they're like, well, I can provide the infrastructure part, which is we've got an office where, you know, you can meet clients. We've got us, you know, safes and security systems and a person who does shipping and an insurance company and all those. All you need to do is, you know the collectors, you know the pieces, so you just handle that part. And I was like, yes, this would actually solve the problem. I mean, you know, help solve the problem, or, you know, be a step towards solving the problem that I talked about, which is having a robust secondary market. So yeah, that was the genesis of it. And, you know, since then, I think others have jumped in and, you know, and when you get really deep pockets like Watchbox and people like that being in the fray, you know, it has really accelerated dramatically.
Yeah, of course.
Still, there is, you know, like the brands like Jorn have, we could even say, taken off, you know, and they are doing well now. As of, you know, a week or two ago, let's say they're officially doing well, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. There's a high watermark on that auction at Philips. That's right. Yeah, definitely.
But just like we say, you know, if the number of watch enthusiasts in the world increased by a factor of 10, some small amount of that would trickle into the independents, right?
Yep.
And similarly, when the amount of people who are interested in independents increase by a huge number, a small number of those will start to trickle into kind of the, you know, you start with the Jorns, but then, you know, you get to the next level, and we're not even there yet. So I think right now we're going to start seeing the next level with kind of the, you know, De Bethunes and Vianney Halters and, you know, Andersons and Calabreses and of the world. That's probably the next place that people start to look now that they've been priced out of, you know, Jorns probably. But we are still so at the infancy of this. So, you know, but at least it's exciting. It feels to me like it's headed in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll put a link in the show notes to Contrapunt so people can check it out. And I think once again, on your podcast, which we've mentioned a few times, Minutia Repeater, which once again, we'll put in the show notes as well. You did this really fantastic episode dissecting the recent Philips auction, and I think you made that exact point that, you know, as the prices of Jaunes go up, there is still some sort of relatively undiscovered gems that you could certainly find, things like Thomas Prescher and, you know, others, even Vianney Holters and a few others, where there's real value because they're doing fantastic work, but they're just, their renown and the collector base hasn't quite caught up with them. So yeah, so I definitely encourage people to listen to that, to the podcast, to your podcast, and, you know, that particular episode really addresses some of those. So that was really well done.
You know, something you talked about earlier, Roman, the Anderson Genève secular perpetual calendar, that is the, other than the, who is it? Frank Muller Mega Turnitus 4, which is like a $3 million watch. Other than that watch, no one has ever done a secular perpetual calendar wristwatch. So, and Anderson only made something on the order of like 15 of the series one of those watches.
Wow.
That's the normal version, you know, with the sharp, pointy, triangular lugs. Like, how is that not a $200,000 watch?
That's exactly right.
But I completely agree with you. I reckon, as ghoulish and awful as this sounds, the value of those watchmakers goes up when they pass away. You know, because they suddenly get this little bump in publicity, a bump in renown, and all of a sudden people go, oh, yeah, you know, they had a whole career of amazing things that we kind of missed. So, yeah, but you're right.
You know, I hope he gets his due in his lifetime, but if he doesn't, he certainly deserves to have it, you know, at some point. Like, we need to have, you know, just like after Daniels passed away, we had the George Daniels auction, which said, whatever, 40 lots and 40 records, you know, everything went for about 10 times more than the high estimate, you know, that, you know, people like Anderson need that also, you know, and that would be, that'd be awesome. If I want them to get their credit in their lifetimes, but regardless, it needs to come at some point.
Yes. And I think their body of work will stand. That's the other thing, you know, that they will get to the pantheon of significant makers who have contributed. And certainly Sven Anderson has, both on the interesting complications, whether it's Montre d'Etat or his erotic watches, or his calendar watches.
Yeah.
But also for the whole idea of setting up the AHCI in the first place, back in the 80s with Vincent Calabresi, to actually give a platform for the indies to really springboard, you know, this whole movement.
Yeah.
Once again, I'm full of horological puns. You know, this whole movement of independent watchmaking. Very, very cool. Well, look, so what's next for you, Kieran? You know, what are you, any exciting projects you want to tell us about, or anything that you want our listeners to know more or about you?
You know, nothing I can think of at the moment, but maybe, you know, check out my Instagram, Kieran_Shaker. That's KIRAN_SHEKAR. And, you know, if something comes up, I'll post it there. I guess that's the best way, maybe. Yeah. And the podcast, you know.
Yeah, the podcast. Yeah, definitely. We'll talk about that in a sec. And the Debethune book. So again, everyone should get the Jaunes book. If you can lay your hand on it, well worth it. When do we have a rough idea when the Debethune book will be in print?
I don't know. And I don't know when it was coming out. And actually, you know, the financial situation of that book is that I don't have a vested interest in the sale. So, you know, no pressure from me. You know, I think you should get it just because you should learn about the company. But, you know, I'm not trying to push sales because I don't get a piece of it. So, you know, that's purely informational as far as informing you guys about the book. It's not, you know, trying to line my pockets, you know.
Oh, no, but look, watch books are a passion of mine, as I've talked on this podcast before.
You're right. That's right. You mentioned that. Yeah.
So, and we had, you know, we had Ryan Schmidt on, author of the Wristwatch Webbook. So if we can help shift some units, I'll be more than happy. You know, I'll buy 3 copies just to get the ball rolling myself. So that's not a problem. All right. Well, look, what we might do then, as we start to wrap up, one of the things we also do is sort of things to discover or people to follow for us and our listeners to grow and expand horizons and things like that. Did you have anyone in mind you could recommend, or anything you think well worth our listeners checking?
Sure. It's not an Instagram thing. I hope that's okay.
Totally.
I would recommend, A, because it's good content, and B, because I would love to see something like this in the watch world, is a car show, car television show.
Okay.
It's a British show that's been around for like 15 years now called Wheeler Dealers.
Oh.
And so it's a 1-hour show, and the first few minutes and the last few minutes of each episode are kind of like, yeah, you can kind of fast forward past them. But it's the only show I can think of, and I watch a lot of car shows, it's the only one I can think of where they're just getting into the nitty gritty all the time.
Cool.
You know, a lot of shows are about body repair, and that's great. But, you know, I'm not saying that's not important, but there's also a dozen shows that do the same body repair.
Mm.
This is the only show where it's like, okay, we're going to rebuild a carburetor on this episode. The next one, we're going to, you know, fix this, I don't know, fix this valve issue we're having, you know, something like that. And it's content that we need more of. It, you know, whether it's in the car world or the watch world or anything, we need more getting into the nitty gritty and not, you know, for some reason, why do people feel the need to make car shows into reality shows?
Mm.
You know, where there has to be drama about, oh, you know, Bob and Jim are not getting along now. Like, really? Is that what it has to be about? Yeah. Like, this is an inherently interesting thing, is repairing a car, and it's not easy.
Sure.
And, you know, let's see it. But this is, I think, the only show I can really think of that actually shows it. And they've been doing it for 15 years, and they do a wide variety of cars, you know, like British, American, German, French, Japanese, everything. So you don't also feel like you're just, okay, well, this show's all about, you know, we just do muscle cars, or we just do this. You get to see a lot. And It bringing it back to watches, it helps you, because so much of what they do in the car world is the same stuff that we do in the watch world when it comes to repairing or making watch stuff.
Mm.
You know, their way of talking about gears is similar to our way of talking about gears. Their way of talking about things like that. You know, it's so similar that it informs your understanding, I think, in the world of watches also, getting that another perspective on a topic.
That's really cool. Yeah, I've brought that up on my laptop now, so I'll have to look that up, check that out. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's fantastic. And as you said, depth of knowledge rather than just superficial eye candy is always, you know, more power to that, both in the car world and certainly in the horological world.
And a lot of another thing I like about, I'm sorry, I'm keep going on about this, but they don't like a lot. There's some shows where it's like, okay, well, these are the problems with the car, so let's throw away all those parts and buy them new. And I'm like, that's okay. That's something. But whereas here it's a lot of rebuilding. It's like the carb doesn't work. Let's figure out why. So it's, you know, you spend half the time on the diagnosis, then the other half on fixing the one problem, and, you know, not throwing the whole thing away and just buying a new one.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way I approach my watch restoration too. I would much rather figure out the problem, try and restore the component, than just say it's no good and replace it. It's there's a lot more you can do if you actually, you know, put the effort in. So that's really cool.
Yeah, it's so satisfying to watch. I was talking to a friend, and his father is a lifelong mechanic, and right now he works at one of the big, you know, manufacturers. He works at a service center, and he said, it's just not worth their time to diagnose the issue.
Yeah.
If the computer says it's an AC problem, they replace the entire AC system.
Yep.
And just charge you for it.
Yep.
You know, it's not worth dialing down to say, ah, this one little plug is broken, or this one pump is broken, this one whatever.
Yep.
No. Replace the whole thing, charge them for it.
It comes down to efficiency, doesn't it, and money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
But it's very unsatisfying as an owner, and, you know, as someone who thinks like, oh, God, all that waste.
Yeah, completely. Completely. I agree.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kieran. That's brilliant. Michael, did you have someone in mind or anything you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I've got, and I don't think I've mentioned them on our podcast before. I hope no one else has, but the Horological Society of New York on Instagram, which is Horological Society of NY, all one word. Yeah, go follow them on Instagram and check out their YouTube channel. They've got some interesting lectures on there. Actually, a few months ago, there was a FP Journe, I believe, which was really, really cool to watch. So, yeah, check them out.
Brilliant. No, that's fantastic. And they do some fantastic content once again. Yeah, FP Journe talk was great. They had Josh Shapiro, friend of the podcast, did a yep. series. Actually, there's been some really fantastic content. So, no, it's a really, really great initiative. We'd need to get something like that in Australia, I think, somewhere.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, I guess I'll go last. I've got someone to follow. It's an Instagram follow at Barna Watches. So it's B-A-R-N-A Watches. We know how to spell those. And the reason I picked this guy, once again, to stay on theme, this person did a recent review on the Fifth Wrist website of an FP Journe Chronometra Sovereign. And when I knew we had Kieran, I'm like, oh, perfect. This is just, you know, stars aligning for that. And also, you know, he's got some pretty cool vintage JLCs and some other pieces as well. So both indies and vintage stuff. So that was Ed Barna Watches, B-A-R-N-A Watches. So, cool. No, fantastic. Yep. Brilliant. Well, look, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much to everyone for joining us today. And, of course, many, many thanks to Kieran for speaking with us. I think it's been a great conversation, sort of spanning a lot of many interesting points. So thank you, Kieran.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it, and I learned from you guys.
Thank you, Kieran. Yeah, it was great talking.
Fantastic. And definitely, everyone, we'll put these in the show notes, but definitely check out contrapunt.com and Kieran's fantastic watch podcast, Minutia Repeater. Definitely well worth listening. Michael and I are huge fans, and I'm sure you will be as well. And finally, the last few words we always say, you know, Fifth Wrist, we set this up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. If you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or even come on the podcast, please get in touch. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram or on our website at fifthwrist.com. Please like and subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. It helps to spread the word. Follow me. I'm at TimesRomanAU. Michael's at Woods Watchmaking and Kieran is at Kieran_Shaker. Thanks very much for joining us today. And as we always say, stay on time.